is University Forum. I'm Gene Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. And this is part two of a very, very important issue to people around this country and around the world. Our topic as we continue today is responding to the catastrophe of Hurricane Katrina. My continuing guest is Dr. Sandra Williams Ortega, who went to New Orleans as a consultant and was a member of the team and a leader in the team to help move things along in that devastated community. Dr. Ortega, thank you so much for continuing this conversation for a second week.
Thank you. Thank you. I must say I felt like a member of the community. I felt that way because the community was so welcoming, and they allowed me to be a member of that community family and to have a voice, and I'm grateful for that.
And New Orleans needed a voice and needed many voices, and we talked last week about all of the devastation that you saw and the complete catastrophe that met you as you were there. And you, as I recall, you moved from not only thinking about crisis counseling, as important as that is, but to a much broader perspective in terms of the role that you would carry there. What was it and what is it that you've been doing, and what is that role that you see yourself doing that put you in that command seat?
There is so much to be done there that it was obvious that no matter what I did, it couldn't be enough. And what my focus became was re-energizing the agency that was responsible for providing services to help rebuild that agency and that agency structure, and to try to create organizations, programs that would enhance the mission of providing service, the mission of that Metropolitan Human Services District. Fact of the matter is, there was a lot to be done. I created forms. As I said, there was no data collection information. We needed to begin to collect information all over again. They needed to know not who was the New Orleans population, but what was the target population. So now that the people have been evacuated, who is here now? Who is coming back to town? Whom must we serve? What new skills are needed to serve this new population? What are the current demographics, ongoing demographics? What I discovered was that there was a huge subpopulation of Latinos, Spanish-speaking people, a huge population of Vietnamese. And so it was critical to inform these people, to talk to them, make sure they knew how to get services, to talk to them as you would talk to English-speaking people about and provide help for them. So there were a lot of things to do. One of the things that I did accomplish was to compile a Spanish language pamphlet, call it booklet, whatever, that was used by emergency medical technicians, by the National Guard, by the police.
How did you do that in terms of Spanish?
Well, just actually, it wasn't me as much as it was my youngest daughter, Julia, who did it. And all it was, and who is a physician's assistant and who works in depressed communities, works with Spanish, and she is Spanish speaking. And so this booklet contained key sentences, key words, key phrases that responders would need, and phonetic translations or phonetic pronunciations. How do you ask a person what's hurting? Those basic kinds of things. Where does it hurt? What happened? And so I was able to put this together for emergency medical, technicians and the police. I was able to work with the Vietnamese population to get flyers out and to inform that population of necessary services, work with Vietnamese doctors and therapists to make sure they provided services. one of the things that I am real proud of was the creation of a wellness center. I was sitting at lunch one day, and those policemen, the first responders, were at the luncheon table complaining or talking. I wore an orange shirt, and they knew that I was a mental health consultant for the federal government. And the minute I sat down, they started bringing me up to date about their concerns. What they had been asking for was help for themselves. This was about the time, after the time that you saw those pictures with a policeman going haywire and beating up a gentleman in the community and all that kind of stuff. And so I asked what they had been asking for, what they needed. And they said, well, we want a place, we need something that I translated to be a wellness center. And what happened was that we were able to negotiate with FEMA to provide a large area, including three rooms in the Hyatt Hotel where the command center was located, and to scrounge. One of the rooms became a de-stressor size and fitness room, and I was able to scrounge exercise equipment. Another room became the chat room because I was real careful not to use words that would keep people away, particularly people who are in non-traditional work careers and all. So one of the room is a chat room. And in this chat room, not only can we provide counseling, but meditation, or quiet space, relaxation. Another room was the larger space where I brought together a staff of Metropolitan Human Services providers who could work with the first responders.
Were these people who came down or people who were living there originally? The staff,
I'll tell you what, that's a good question, because from the Metropolitan Human Services organization, keep in mind that these people were not working at the time because all their buildings, their clinics, everything had been destroyed. So we needed to put them to work. So I borrowed the social worker who was also a fitness expert. I borrowed the nurse who did body mass, all this kind of stuff, glucometers, who could create a wellness profile and help a person track his well-being or her well-being. I borrowed psychiatrists and a psychologist. And then beyond that, when I discovered that National Guardsmen and policemen and different people who were the first responders did not respond to this approach, what I did is to bridge that gap between that would lead to counseling and by bringing in or negotiating with alternative medicine people. And this got them so that I was able to bring on board lady who did chair massages, woman who was a massager, able to bring on board a group called Acupuncturists Without Borders, able to bring on board the Church of Scientology that has a ministry, a volunteer ministry. So I put all this together, and so the alternative medicine approach was able, everybody needs a massage.
Sure.
And so once they came there and once they got their acupuncture and all, they were willing, freed them up to start talking and to be those other services.
Meeting them where they were.
And so that's still going. It needs tending. And I'm thinking that I want to get back down there so I can really pay attention to that and help that really
be
sustained.
How long were you there?
I was only there over 6 weeks. 6 weeks.
That's a long time during that time.
It is a long time. And what they say in this crisis disaster field is that you shouldn't stay in a place like that for more than 2 weeks.
Burnout.
For the burnout. But I was there for 6 weeks off and on. There's so much to do. I did went into communities that were not served. A lot of communities where people feel forgotten, not just by the federal government, but by their own communities. A huge, huge community called the Christopher Homes. And I went there one day on a Sunday early to help do a population survey. And who's here? I mean, whom are we supposed to be taking care of? Who are our, you know, citizens? And I saw a gentleman sitting on the side, two gentlemen sitting in the sidewalk. One was drinking some beer. There was music coming out of a home. These are real close together row homes. I started talking to him and I introduced myself. And next thing I know, he had gotten me a milk crate to sit on. And we were there talking. I looked around and people were coming out of their homes. I mean, they were, it had nothing to do with me. It was just that nobody had come to visit them or to offer services. So
here one of you were putting community together.
Oh, community. This is a community. And I was so impressed by one of the ladies, a Mrs. Adams Green, I think her name is, who was so articulate. And she said to me, these people think, she said, she pointed to her little house. She said, this house is my mansion. That's what she said to me. She said, I have worked for 37 years to pay for my home. This is my home and nobody's running me anywhere. But she was also talking about the fact that she needed help to get it fixed. Mm-hmm. No help, no job. Nobody had jobs, no medicine. And all of these people surrounding me were needy. One gentleman had just returned from Houston and he'd gone to Houston because he had diabetes of the worst kind, and he had to go to Houston where his cousin said, come here and we'll get you some medicine. Mm-hmm. And so he had returned and we were talking about the issues and the needs. They had no transportation. So you're talking about a community that couldn't help itself, that could not help itself. And as the way I see it, if people can't help themselves, we have an obligation to seek them out and provide care.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest, Dr. Sandra Williams-Ortega. We're talking about Katrina, and I think we're talking about much more than that, and that is the responsibility that we have to see that when things go wrong, somehow they can be set right.
Yes, particularly when the things that go wrong are not of your doing. They were foretold.
Talk about the levees.
Oh, goodness. You talk to the people, and as anybody would in the situation they're in, they believe that this was a conspiracy. And it's understandable, because what they know is that this was known about. They know that the levee weakness was known about. They know that all kinds of surveys had been taken. They know ultimately that the government opted not to safeguard them. They know now that, you know, in all this hassle over rebuilding, the question is, why is there no consideration to rebuilding the levees to ensure our safety? So there are some practical questions and some implications for public policy gone awry.
Absolutely.
And as I see it, unconscionable behavior. It just seems to me sometimes that there is a lack of creativity in problem solving and in looking at issues. But I just wonder, what is it that keeps the greatest nation in the world from ensuring that everybody is protected?
I mean, they know there's a problem. They knew it was coming.
Knew it was coming.
Now that it has happened, the question is, they know it has to be changed.
It has to be changed.
But maybe that is where the rub is.
And how does a levee that was created to withstand what was it, hurricane, Category 3 hurricane? We had said 5, but it wasn't. We discovered it was built to sustain a Category 3 hurricane. How come it didn't? Mm-hmm. How come it didn't? And if it didn't, how is it the fault of those people who were caught up in that destruction?
In other words, the blame has to shift away from those who were the victims. It's that traditional concept of blaming the victim.
And since they are not at fault, are we not responsible for ensuring that this problem is righted as a nation?
How do you help? Your whole world is around the whole notion of self-empowerment. But how can
Indeed
self-empowerment work in this way? What do you see in using that as really a definable tool?
Yeah. One of the things that we have to know always is that being defeated does not mean that you are, you know, something, a crisis has happened. It means that, it does not mean that you have been beat up and knocked to the ground. It, defeat only comes when you don't respect your inner fortitude and your ability to get up again. The empowerment comes when, and we had we've had a lot of discussions in New Orleans about this. Empowerment comes when you stand up again and face another day. When you keep on going in spite of everything. One of the ladies who was an employee of Metropolitan Human Services District, who was just a fantastic woman, as all of them are, I saw her one day. She came to the Emergency Operations Center, the command center, to sit at the health desk, and she looked so gorgeous. And I said to her, how do you manage to look so beautiful when you've lost everything? I mean, you don't even have a place to stay. She said, I just got these out of the Goodwill bag. I said, boy, don't you look good. And she was so pleased. I mean, she just did what she had to do to keep on trucking. This is self-empowerment. This is just having the strength and knowing that you are a survivor and you're going to make it. The hardship will not keep you down. It's just something that's a humongous barrier that you have to continue fighting and working to get over and come to the other side of it. And people are doing that. The way they are doing it is by surviving. I mean, just imagine what it took to survive what they did. After surviving, they had to get their families together. I mean, they had to find a place to stay. So they had to come up with a plan to stay with this person, stay in a tent, stay in a hotel. They had to master the mounds of paperwork. If you saw the FEMA application for help that I have in my possession, you would gasp.
They weren't getting much help in finding places in the way they needed in time.
No, there are disaster relief centers down there. There, I must say, there are a lot of help. There's Catholic Services. There's Red Cross.
The kinds of agencies that are there now and where the churches are in all of this.
The churches are there. As a matter of fact, some of the churches were the first to be there, the first to to pull the communities together.
There's some talk now that only through the building of the interfaith arrangements with the churches will there be a way of really reviving the soul of this community.
I think that's certainly one way. I don't believe that's the only way. I just think it's a great way. It's a political way, and as long as the money gets to people, so be it. But certainly that's not the only way. What would stop our government from just getting the money there? Why do we need a faith-based mechanism? We don't. Everything is interwoven in politics, which I appreciate if it works. Now, I'm not to say that that's not a good thing, because the churches are responding. The churches are responding very well. But this is just the way I think that one of the ways that the government is going about doing the business, you could stand on a street corner, on any street corner in the French Quarter or Christopher Holmes or anywhere else and give out money. So you don't need a mechanism, a faith-based mechanism, which is a great, great thing. But, I mean, you don't need any kind. All you need to do is give the money to the people
who
need
it.
What
I hear you saying is that a critical need, then, is to have the money and then, of course, have the tools or the wherewithal in order to do some of this construction or building and to really fix the city.
Fix the city. Critical need is for the government, every layer of government, to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. From where I sat in the command center, day in and day out, with arguments that never went anywhere, that never addressed the issues, even though people, particularly volunteer agencies, tried real hard to put pieces together. But in the face of no money, they were hamstrung. It was baffling to me how we just could not seem to come up with the bottom line. The people need help. Let's get the money. Let's fix their homes. Let's make a decision at this moment.
Who would the let's be from where you sit?
The let's from where I would sit would be every level of authority, every level of government, from certainly including the mayor, the government, but the federal government, which certainly has the big pot of money. People, I think now, hopefully they're working together a lot more. I keep hearing a lot of people, legislators, saying, let's stop with the blame game. Well, okay, that's fine. But now, when will we be able to get together in a communal way, all these layers of government, and put the money on the table so that it reaches the least of us?
Repetitive question, not only in the Katrina area, but in so many desperate areas of this country.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit, for the remaining minutes that we have, about one of the big things that you're trying to do to help pay tribute to the, what do you call them, the survivors?
Yes. And I know that everybody, all these agencies we talked about, a lot of credit, including certainly the churches, faith-based, and all of them, individuals, give them a lot of credit. We've worked very hard to make things better. Certainly the city of Philadelphia has been an anchor in all of that support. But when I returned home, to my home in New Jersey the last time, I just felt jagged somehow. I came home and I talked to a lady on a plane, and she had a little baby, and she said that she was going to get her child. Her child, she had to send a 7-year-old to her aunt. So you listen to all these stories of displacement, and I knew something was missing. And for all the work that I felt I was doing, it just wasn't – it needed something else. And I said, I got to tap into the Morgan State University Choir, my alma mater. There's none better. There's no music that touches the soul so deeply. And so I've been working with the Morgan State University Choir, Dr. Eric Conway, and the college to bring the choir to New Orleans to pay tribute to the people and the city. It's going to, I hope, be a massive tribute on the 22nd of March. Choir has moved everything out of the way to go to New Orleans to say to the people, we respect you, we appreciate you. We love you. They need a pat on the back. It's long overdue. Morgan State Choir is going there on the 22nd to have a gala tribute in honor of those citizens, the residents.
Oh, that's going to be marvelous. Do you want to share with anybody how they might contact you if they want to help in supporting
I do
that?
Because yeah. I am looking for sponsors. It's going to be costly. We got to take a bus load of about 60 choir members down to the South, feed them for 2 days, house them in hotels.
Give us an email or someplace where they could contact you.
If they could call or contact me at, I'll say it and then I'll spell it, OrtegaAsso@AOL.com. It stands for Ortega Associates, OrtegaAsso@AOL.com, or My phone number, 856-596-0191.
Give that number again.
856-596-0191. We need help. We need sponsorship. And your name will appear on the program.
Oh, that's wonderful. It sounds like you're trying to bring some, not just what you have done, but to bring some of the vitality that your alma mater will bring.
Yes.
And, of course, we know Morgan State.
Oh, something State. Deeper than what I've done.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you so much for all that you have done and all that you continue to do, a person who has had so much involvement in helping people, helping communities, in helping countries around this world.
Yes.
Because you sit at the highest level of government when you are talking with different countries about the needs that they have.
Well,
and
I thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Moore. This is always a pleasure.
Well,
always
I thank you for being my guest on University Forum. I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.